Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Fear and trembling.
Faith versus reason.
The sickness unto death.
The philosophy of Søren Kierkegaard.
Nothingness, non-existence, black emptiness.
What'd you say?
I was just planning my future.
Can we only face the world with resignation and despair?
If only God would give me some sign. If he would just speak to me once. Anything, one sentence, two words. If he would just cough.
How can we achieve direct union with the divine?
Is faith a mystery?
Is faith a paradox?
Just one miracle. If I could see a burning bush or the seas part or my Uncle Sasha pick up a check.
The philosophy of Kierkegaard.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, the philosophy of Søren Kierkegaard.
Ken, Kierkegaard is really high on my list of philosophers.
Which list of philosophers?
The list of philosophers that I haven't read much of, don't understand at all, and doubt that I ever will.
John, that's quite an admission, John. It betrays a large gap in your philosophical education, I'm afraid. Kierkegaard was a very important Danish philosopher of the early and mid-19th century. I mean, he criticized Hegel severely. I would have thought that would warm your heart. So what's the problem? Just never got around to giving Kierkegaard a try?
No, Kent, I've tried a number of times. Admittedly, he didn't like Hegel. That's good. But apart from that, he just seems to exemplify everything I dislike in a philosopher. I like philosophers who tell you what they think in clear and a straightforward manner. Kierkegaard wrote under a bunch of pseudonyms. I guess he wrote poetically, but to me it just comes across as turgid. I think reason is the method of philosophy. Kierkegaard thinks we should accept contradictions and make leaps of faith. Ugh.
Oh, John. Well, you know, Kierkegaard was poetic, and he is sometimes turgid. I have to admit that. But I don't think you've got him quite right. I mean, Kierkegaard thinks we have to accept paradoxes, but I wouldn't say he thinks we have to accept contradictions.
And the difference is?
Well, Christianity is full of what Kierkegaard calls paradoxes, like that Jesus is both human and divine. That is a paradox. It's a paradox because we, with our reason, can't hope to figure out how it could be so. But it's not a contradiction because Jesus is both human and divine in the Christian universe. To say Jesus is both divine and not divine, now that would be a contradiction. Kierkegaard doesn't say we should accept logical contradictions like that, but he does think we very much do need to accept things that we can't hope to understand with human reason.
Okay, so a leap of faith isn't accepting a contradiction, it's just accepting something you can't hope to understand and acting on it. Why should anyone make a leap of faith? Why should we accept something we don't understand and act on it, especially if our actions lead to crazy behavior that affects others, like Abraham getting ready to kill his son Isaac because God told him to? Kierkegaard thought that was really cool, right?
Yeah, he thought Abraham was actually in that action the great exemplar of faith. Now, he admits that Abraham's kind of paradoxical, and I suppose Abraham himself has a paradox because Abraham knew it was morally wrong to kill Isaac, but God was commanding him to kill Isaac, so Abraham thought it was his religious duty to kill Isaac, and he would have killed Isaac if the angel hadn't intervened with a reprieve from God. Abraham was completely, completely ready to obey God, to take a leap of faith, even though he didn't understand how to fit it all together, the demands of the ethical and the demands of God into a coherent picture. And he also was prepared to kill Isaac with the utter confidence that God would find a way to make this all right.
So tell me, I mean, why was Abraham better than Agamemnon, who sacrificed his own daughter to bring success at Troy?
Because Agamemnon was not doing this thing that goes beyond reason, goes beyond the ethical. Agamemnon was doing what the morality of his time dictated. He was killing a loved one, that's to be sure. That's a bad thing. But in order to bring success in battle and save his city-state, I mean, that's sometimes you have to sacrifice something that you cherish by doing something higher. Now, for Kierkegaard, complying with traditional morality. Killing Abraham wasn't complying with traditional morality. That goes beyond that. And traditional morality isn't the best kind of life. One should obey one's own inner subjectivity, one's own inwardly felt religious duty, especially when one recognizes it as from God. That's what Abraham was doing.
Yeah, well, Kierkegaard and you seem to feel strongly about this, Ken, but it seems to me Abraham was obviously nuts, a psychotic who almost committed murder. Why would any philosopher approve of such a thing?
Well, you know, I have to admit that in my own moments, I have my suspicions about Abraham's sanity. But, I mean, don't you think Kierkegaard has at least a kind of a point? Isn't the person who marches to the beat of a different drummer, an internal drummer, someone to be admired often? I mean, the person who has the courage of her convictions. Think of John Brown, the anti-slavery zealot. He was probably a bit unbalanced, but I admire his passionate desire to end slavery, however ill-considered some of his actions might have been.
Well, all right, you've got a point there. I kind of admire John Brown, too. But look, inwardly, Abraham doesn't understand what he's being asked to do. He can't make sense of it, and yet he's going to act on it. Now, maybe John Brown accepted a lot of Christian paradoxes, I don't know. But when it came to the attack on Harper's Ferry, he understood why he was doing it. I suspect he had a very clear and consistent internal story about why slavery was wrong and how raiding Harper's Ferry might help to alleviate that. But people who take radical actions like murder on the basis of beliefs they don't really understand and can't make sense of, I still don't see what's admirable about that.
Well, John, I think we need a little help in making you appreciate Kierkegaard's subtlety.
Well, you're right, and I hope some of our listeners can help. Take the leap of telephonic faith. The number is 1-800...
You're listening to an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
And we've asked our colleague Lanier Anderson to join us. Lanier is a professor of philosophy at Stanford and has particular expertise in 19th century philosophical thinking.
But before we talk to Lanier, our roving philosophical reporter, April Dembowski, has been talking to people about everyday leaps of faith. She files this report.
There's a Hollywood version of falling in love.
I've loved you ever since the first second I saw you.
Man waits all his life for a woman like that.
I'll love you for the rest of my life.
And then there's real life.
There always seems to be something that's wrong with the person.
Alicia is 36 and lives in San Francisco. She's been dating since she was 15.
Every person is sort of like, oh, this drives me nuts, or I don't feel at ease as I should. I think there's a lot of shoulds in dating.
And a lot of criteria. Alicia has a list.
Intelligent, like quite intelligent. A little ironic and a little critical. Someone who likes being outside. Someone who really wants to continue their search of developing themselves.
She finally met a guy who measured up against her checklist. There was just one thing at first.
He was very into me in the beginning and I was a little worried. Because he was so into me, and I didn't feel like he knew me, and so I was a little ambivalent. And then I think he got to know me better and then became ambivalent himself. And really, when I say ambivalence, I mean fear.
Now Alicia feels caught in a web of her own doubts and rationalizations.
I'm to the point where it feels like I need to take a leap of faith. It's gonna work out, and I need to put my ambivalence and all the thoughts in my head that are screaming, is this right? I don't know if this is right. Jump ship. And then part of me is saying, no, stay.
This is a tension that Oakland therapist Dan Weil often sees. He's been counseling couples for 30 years.
There's a kind of person who falls in love easily. And there's a kind of person who doesn't do that, who, while really liking the partner, has worries and hesitancies. Is this the right one? Is there someone better?
Weil helps couples have constructive conversations about commitment, but sometimes talking it through just isn't enough.
For the type of person who does not immediately say, yes, this is it, the decision to get married is always a leap of faith. That person has to work through, well, nothing's perfect, but I've looked around enough, so I'll go for it.
But going on faith doesn't end at the altar. Couples have to take leaps of faith over and over again. Maybe one partner wants a baby and the other doesn't. Or political views suddenly become an issue. Or maybe there's an affair.
The idea is to solve the moment rather than solve the problem.
Weil tries to get couples to focus on feelings rather than fighting.
We would try to get them kind of sad together about how one is being disappointed and the other one is feeling pressured and what a difficult position that is, and hoping that by having those kind of conversations, they'll be able to work something out.
A therapist can't engineer a leap of faith, but they seem to come easier when couples work with each other, not against each other.
They can find themselves saying these vulnerable things that if they were thinking about it, they might say, I'm not going to say this. He could use it against me later on. When you're in the collaborative mode, in the loving mode, you can forget a lot of these dangers and do the leap of faith kind of automatically without any effort or thinking at all.
Falling in love may require a leap of faith, but then again, so might staying in love. For Philosophy Talk, I'm April Demboski.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest is Lanier Anderson. He's a professor of philosophy at Stanford University. He's a resident expert on all things 19th century and philosophical. Lanier, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Lanier, tell us briefly how your love of 19th century philosophy in general, and Kierkegaard in particular, came to be. Some sort of softness for lost causes?
I don't think that was quite it. With Kierkegaard in particular, I started reading it just because I had to teach it in a class. And then I really got into it because it reminded me, or it helped explain to me, something about the weird inner logic of the faith of people that I knew when I was growing up.
Well, give us a little more background on Kierkegaard. What motivated this strange fellow, and what were his most important doctrines in a nutshell, no pun intended?
Well, I think he was mainly worried about certain alienating effects of modern life, and especially ones attached to the decay of commitment to our traditional religiously motivated life ways. And maybe there are two main areas where that came out. Kierkegaard was deeply opposed to the Hegelian project of explaining how the world is fundamentally rational and how it could be justified in terms that everybody can understand. And he was also very upset about the sort of terrorization of religious consciousness. He was worried that people made things too easy for themselves.
Wait a minute. So he's worried about the deep alienating aspects of modern life, but I take it this Hegelian reason thing is supposed to make us at home in the world because it's rational through and through, and religion gets to be, has a rational basis, and it would be good if Christianity were easy rather than hard, because that would be accessible rather than inaccessible. So that all sounds kind of paradoxical.
Maybe we should just say we're talking about Georg Hegel, who was a rough contemporary of Kierkegaard and who was, you know, the German philosopher for the 19th century.
I mean, Kierkegaard make us more alienated in some ways?
Well, he thinks that the Hegelians are making things way too easy for themselves by thinking that everything in the world is going to turn out to be rational and okay. And, you know, let's go back to that case of Abraham, right? Kierkegaard wants us to realize that if God is not going to be, and God's commands are not going to be just irrelevant to our ethical life, then it must be possible for God to command us to do something that's against what reason would suggest. And that's what happens in the Abraham case. And, you know, Hegel is just trying to push that under the rug.
Right. So religion has to be hard. Faith has to be beyond reason. It has to be hard for us to come, and then we're more at home in the world. That's the part I don't get. Because you said you worried. He said he was deeply worried about alienation, but it sounds like I don't understand why he doesn't make us more alienated. But you know, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought and tell us why we're not more alienated in the Kierkegaardian picture than we start out with. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're discussing Kierkegaard with Lanier Anderson.
We've been getting a brief overview of this enigmatic but important philosopher. In the next segment, we're really going to focus on his concept of a leap of faith. So take a leap yourself. Give us a call, 1-800.
You're hearing an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
9917. And you can also send us email at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Faith leaping, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Stay one.
Bob Dylan's retelling of the story of Abraham, the classic biblical leap of faith. It was Soren Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher, theologian, and psychologist, who talked about the leap of faith and how it was necessary for belief in or true love of God, or, matter of fact, any kind of true love, perhaps. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk. Have you ever taken a leap of faith? How? In what context? What does it take to make that leap? Courage, folly, or something else? The number is 1-800.
This is an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
Or you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest today is Lanier Anderson from Stanford's Philosophy Department.
So, Lanier, I want to go back. Eventually, I want to get back to the question I was asking you before the break about alienation and how this is supposed to make us more at home in the world. But let's dig into this concept of a leap of faith, because I think that'll help us lay some groundwork. I told John a leap of faith is when you inwardly accept an act and a paradox, something you don't understand, but you believe and act anyway. Is that basically right, or how would you characterize that?
I think that is basically right. It's a special attitude that you take toward this paradoxical demand or paradoxical object of belief, paradoxical content. And it's important in important ways. It's defined by contrast to a rational belief in that thing. When you believe on the basis of faith, for Kierkegaard, it's in a way that goes against what reason would demand of you. And I think that the roving philosophical segment was on to something in focusing on that case about love. So imagine that you're trying to say that you're in love with a person, and you come to your partner and you say, well, I'm in love with you for three or four reasons, and here they are, I enumerate them. As soon as you do that, you're testifying against yourself that you're not really in love. If you're really in love, then your attitude of love, your feeling of love, way outstrips any reasons that you could give, and it's that sort of thing that Kierkegaard's thinking faith should be like.
Okay, so let me make a contrast here. There was another famous anti-Hegelian, Schopenhauer. Schopenhauer's idea was a world is will and idea, and will was this primordial thing that pushes us to do things that are really stupid. Like if he were living today, he would say, you know, why do you want to get married? They almost all end in divorces or unhappiness. Why do you want to have children? They'll soak up all your money, right? That's the will, right? Manipulating your ideas, which are an illusion, and leading you to do things you shouldn't do. Is there kind of a deep analogy there with Kierkegaard? He thinks we also have this deep primordial need, but he kind of approves of it. I mean, they both look at the irrational, and Schopenhauer says that's your will playing a trick on you, and Kierkegaard says, no, that's the essence of Christianity. Take your leap, have your children, get married, which, by the way, he chickened out of his marriage, if I remember correctly.
That's true, he did. And you might think of his whole philosophy as a retrospective way of explaining to himself why he did and what went wrong and how he failed to become failed to have enough faith to carry through with that.
So, I mean, just so our listeners will have the facts, he had a fiance.
They seemed to be
very Regina Olson. They seemed very much in love. He backed out kind of at the last moment. Then she ended up marrying someone else, and that drove him crazy for the rest of his life. That's my take on it.
Well, he started writing even before she got together with the other guy, trying to explain to her and himself, I think, why he couldn't go through with it. But really, to contrast Kierkegaard and Schopenhauer, Kierkegaard thinks that there are two different kinds of non-rational attachments that we might have to projects or to things in the world. The ones that are based on mere desire, he might even agree with Schopenhauer that they're really bad, and that they should be overcome by our reason. And our reason gives us ethical rules that help us to live in a way that detaches us from these mere desires. But the thought is that even these rational ethical rules are themselves not everything, and that there's a further attitude of faith that goes beyond them and that puts us directly into relationship with God, and that's what we're really called to do.
Right. Okay. So look, I'm going to get let's get back to Abraham. Just Kierkegaard wrote a book, Fear and Trembling, which is a constant meditation on Abraham and the paradox of Abraham and the paradox of faith, which is, I think, a really fine book. I it's dense and thick, but it's a beautiful book. So look, let's get back to Abraham, though. Abraham was called to kill Isaac, or sacrifice Isaac. And it's just, this inner voice says, I guess, kill Isaac. And the leap of faith is, I guess, going ahead and killing Isaac, being ready to kill Isaac, despite the fact that everything that reason says, don't do that.
Isaac being his own son.
His own son, who he got out of faith, I guess, because God promised him Isaac, and now God's going to take him back. You know, if God said, kill Isaac, whom I promised you, I'd say, are you really God? Why should I believe you? I mean, isn't this leap of faith just a form of, like, schizophrenia or something like that?
Well,
you know, thought insertion, this strange voice talking to you?
It does seem very strange. So Kierkegaard has a nice way of talking about this. He points out that the ethical description for what Abraham is asked to do is to murder his own son. The religious description of what he's asked to do is that he's asked to sacrifice the very best to God. So in one sense, what's really going on with the leap of faith is whether you can contain your anxiety enough to adopt the religious interpretation of what you're being asked to do. If you know, the leap of faith just is thinking of the thing religiously and not as a murder.
Right. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about Kierkegaard with Lanier Anderson. We're talking right now about the leap of faith. And we want to know, have you made a leap of faith? Would you make a leap of faith? Small leaps of faith? Big leaps of faith? Give us a call. 1-800.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
You can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. Okay, let's dig into this a little bit more. Okay, can I adopt the religious name for what I'm called by this inner voice to do? Sacrifice rather than murder, but it's still, why should I adopt it? So I've got my reason, right? I'm a thoroughly rational, secular guy. I've got my reason. I've got the ethical commandments that are delivered to me through reason. So don't kill Isaac. Don't kill anybody, unless for some higher thing like Agamemnon. And then do it, sadly, with anguish, not gladly and willingly, as Abraham was willing to sacrifice Isaac. I mean, what's supposed to get this leap of faith even going? Right?
It's all about your individual relationship to God. So I taught a course on Kierkegaard with a colleague of mine at Stanford, Ken Taylor. Oh, there you are, right there. And he made the excellent point in lecturing on Kierkegaard that this leap of faith symbolizes for us the thought that we are something more than all of the particular things that we might be attached to in the world, including even the most important demands of ethics and rationality on us. We are something more than that. And why are we something more than that? Because we are creatures of God and called by God to be in an individual relationship with Him.
And this has to do with something, the thing you were talking about. Now we're getting to the thing you were talking about, the alienation, right? Because Kierkegaard has another fine book, The Sickness Unto Death. The name of that sickness unto death is despair, and he thinks despair is everywhere. It's like the condition of human beings who have not made this leap of faith. Every single human being who has not made this leap of faith has some version of despair. Explain that to us.
Well, despair is the condition of not being in faith, of being hopeless about your position in the world and about the value of your life. And he thinks that despair is, in fact, sin— because what God demands of us is to have faith that He will order things in a good way for us. And if we don't have that faith, then we're defying God and God's command for us to take...
John.
Boy, that is complicated and weird. I'd say if you understand despair, spend winter in Denmark. I mean, look... I would like to understand this at least in the sense of relating it to larger currents. Now Kierkegaard got in trouble with the Lutheran Church in Denmark, I believe, but it wasn't because he wasn't Protestant enough. He's kind of the super Protestant.
That's right.
I have two friends who are both philosophers of religion, a married couple, and I remember years ago when I knew them well, he used to come up with... rationales for the Trinity, how you could understand the Trinity so it made sense. And her response always was, that's got to be wrong because it doesn't make sense. You have to accept it on faith. So those are kind of two poles, and I think that she was the more Protestant of the two. Is that right? Is this whole Kierkegaardian thing that it's an individual understanding and you'll never get it straight because it's intrinsically mysterious? Is that all wrapped up in being a Protestant?
Maybe it is wrapped up in being a Protestant. But anyway, I think the Protestant Catholic divide doesn't really separate your two friends.
It's more the Hegel-Kierkegaard divide.
It's the Hegel-Kierkegaard divide. Yeah. It's whether you think that a reason can be given that makes ultimate sense of the religious symbol. And what your second friend, let's call her Marilyn, what your second friend was saying is like what I was saying about the person in love. She was saying, look, you're supposed to be committed to the religious symbol in a way that goes beyond this rationalization that you're coming up with. And if you just stick to that rationalization, you're admitting that your commitment stops there and isn't a thing that goes beyond any mere little reason that you would come up with.
But why couldn't the same framework be applied in what I would think would be a bad way towards things like patriotism? You know, my country, right or wrong. I don't really understand why America is better than other countries, but it's part of being an American to accept that on faith. Is that kind of thinking really any different than Kierkegaard is recommending with respect to the religion he happened to grow up in?
I think it's structurally quite similar, and he does too, I think. So when he talks about the Abraham case, he thinks that what's most characteristic of it is that you're taking a huge risk to bet that this is the demand of God and not some schizophrenic voice or, you know, some thought insertion or some immoral desire of your own. And that's a huge risk that you're taking. The question is whether you're actually in the God relationship or not.
And that's partly why that book is called Fear and Trembling, because you take this risk with fear and trembling. 1-800-5-
This is an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
We've got John from San Carlos on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, John.
Hey, how are you?
What's your comment or question?
The point you guys had about Abraham, Abraham's faith, it wasn't something that kind of began right there in the situation where he was told to kill Isaac. It actually began prior to that with Isaac's birth. So the fact that Isaac exists to him is almost reason enough to have faith.
Well, it is. Thanks, John. It is. Isaac was a gift of God, right? Who promised that Abraham that he would, you know, seed the generations through Isaac. But then God takes him back. He says, "Give me back him." So
Isaac was the one that Sarah, who'd been
barren
for years, had as a. Yeah. Abraham was what, 600 years old or something by then?
Old.
Yeah. So, I mean, of course, Abraham had a lot more time to think about this than I have had.
Yeah. But I want to put another kind of question to you. I want to get back to the despair, because I don't quite agree that it's structural, that it's just craziness. Because I think faith for Kierkegaard is supposed to be a solution to a deep human problem. This problem of the self and who am I and what am I, right? I look at the world. The world offers me up stuff. It offers me up glory and riches and all that sort of stuff. But then I have all these desires that go beyond what the world offers up. What do? I give up my desires? Nah. I hold on to them. But the world doesn't offer. I hold on to desires that the world won't satisfy. And then what am I? I'm sad. I'm dissatisfied. I'm alienated from the world. And if I only believe in my own ability, my own self-constitution, without turning toward God, I'm just, what does he call it? Fantastical or something like that. So I can't remember the exact phrase. And only when I turn to God can I recognize fully the self that I am, can I fully ground that self. So faith is a kind of solution to a problem that all human beings face. I mean, is that right, roughly?
You're really into this.
I think he's profound. What do you think, Winnie?
I think that's right, in the sense that Kierkegaard thinks that there's something in us of the infinite, but we're also, of course, finite, limited creatures. And because there's something in us of the infinite, our desires are always going to outstrip what we ourselves can accomplish in the world. And if we don't fall back on God and rely on his help, then will always be doomed to be in this position of frustration that you described.
This is what people think of Kierkegaard as an existentialist, and I guess rightly, but you think, how can he be an existentialist? Aren't most existentialists atheists? But there's some kind of commonality between people like Sartre and Nietzsche and Kierkegaard. Do you think that's right?
So my favorite story about existentialism is that there are three kinds of existentialists. The ones who were dead before there was any such word, and Kierkegaard's one of those. The ones who denied that they were existentialists and had that confirmed by Sartre, and then the third class includes Sartre. But in spite of that funny classification, there is a kind of family resemblance between Kierkegaard and these other existentialists. Maybe you should think of it this way, that he puts all this weight on the anxiety that we have about finding an individual, a justified individual place in the world for ourselves. And he thinks that somehow these characteristic emotional attitudes like anxiety or dread or despair or faith are going to help us see our way to the right resolution of that problem.
Right. It's by working through this. Is this right? I'm not quite sure. But it's only by working through these kind of layers of despair. He thinks despair comes in many different forms. But it's only by working through these layers of despair that you'll get to this point where you can make this leap of faith.
Well, he thinks that people who haven't ever figured out what it is to be in despair are basically shallow people and haven't really confronted the problem. And in that sense, you need despair to take the next step. But it is required for you not to be in despair, and you should not confuse your despair with any kind of virtue. It's sin, Ken.
So here's an email. It's a little bit of a digression, but it's a serious email, so I think we ought to hear it. John in Berkeley says, sometimes Kierkegaard seems, as in the argument of philosophical fragments, to be a serious exponent of Hegelian dialectic. Other times, he seems to be satirizing Hegelianism, as in the attack on Christendom. So what's the real story? This question's been bothering me since we got started.
Yeah, briefly tell us what the real story is.
So I think the real story is this. Kierkegaard thinks that this dialectical reasoning that Hegel goes through, where we somehow make opposites come together, he thinks that that often works and that we can resolve a lot of contradictions by doing that. But it can't work in every case. And so he wants to do that dialectic in a very precise way so that he can identify exactly those cases where no amount of rational dialectical work can get you from one stage to another stage, and you have to actually take the leap of faith against your reason.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing Kierkegaard with Lanier Anderson from Stanford University.
We've talked about who Kierkegaard was and his idea of a leap of faith. Faith and reason, or faith versus reason, is a time-honored philosophical issue. In our next segment, we'll dig deeper into this perennial question and what Kierkegaard has to say about it.
Faith, reason, and your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
A leap of faith, a major idea, a concept Bruce Springsteen got from Soren Kierkegaard, the great philosopher. Sometimes we focus on individual thinkers. Today, Kierkegaard is our man. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Lanier Anderson from Stanford University.
Lanier, it seems to me that most philosophers of religion, from Augustine to Aquinas to our own contemporary Robert Adams, typically attempt to reconcile faith and reason. Where does Kierkegaard fit into this, or does he just not fit into
it? It seems like he's trying to drive them as far apart as possible.
He's trying to drive them as far apart as possible. He thinks that that whole tradition is on the wrong track, because what is demanded of us is not to reduce God to our level and make God's religion turn out to be just what reason would demand. He thinks that what God's demanding of us is to humiliate our reason and rest our faith in him.
So the problematic that we think of as the philosophy of religion, starting at least with Augustine, going through Aquinas and so many others, he just thinks is wrongheaded.
He thinks that those people didn't understand what was important about the genuine orthodox tradition in the faith. He thinks that they're That they're corrupting the faith.
1-800-525.
This is why he got in such trouble with the Danish church.
1-800-525.
This is an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Judy.
Okay, thanks. What bothers me is that Abraham, in his leap of faith, was stepping outside his own situation and killing another human being. Why does his leap of faith have to take his son's life? That should be personal.
That's a term in that for Kierkegaard, just so you know. The teleological suspension of the ethical. He was stepping outside of the ethical, but Lanier, explain to Judy what's going on.
So the teleological suspension of the ethical is the thought that the ethical could be suspended, that is, rejected, in favor of some higher purpose, namely God's faith. And I think the reason that the story is supposed to be so powerful, or anyway, that's Kierkegaard's interpretation, is precisely this disturbing aspect of it that Judy has picked out. It's because what Abraham is asked to do is so awful that his willingness to do it is supposed to be so great and so high.
So a modern Bay Area person might think of the leap of faith as drinking the Kool-Aid. Christine Ellis points out, because there's this analogy with the people at Jonestown that followed their leader's insistence, all drank the Kool-Aid and died. Does Kierkegaard have any test, any criterion Abraham could have used, or he could use, or I could use, to tell when we're being talked to by God and when we're being talked to by a charlatan?
Well, there's no test, and that's why faith is risky and great when you have it. It's all about whether, in fact, you are in the proper individual relationship to God or not. And if you ask for some criterion, some test that your reason could assess, then you're asking for the wrong kind of attitude.
Another interesting email from Paul. In Plato's famous Apologia of Socrates, Socrates explains that he's acting in response to his demon. Would not count as a leap of faith? And also, Socrates is one of the people that Kierkegaard refers to a lot.
Kierkegaard loves that fact about Socrates. Although, of course, Socrates can't count as the genuine knight of faith because he's not a Christian. But Kierkegaard thinks that he was dimly aware of the need for such a thing, and that came out in his relation to that demon.
I want to pick up on that. Look, Kierkegaard wants is offering. I don't know if he wants, but he's offering, and he believes in a very demanding Christianity.
That's right.
I mean, it's a very demanding thing, because your reason, which is an instrument, I guess, that God has given you, right? I guess it's to faith. It's sort of like perception, or, you know, perception tells you all these things, and sometimes your reason says, no, that's just wrong, and you have to go with your reason. Well, faith sometimes tells you, reason tells you these things, and faith says, no, that's not what God wants. And your reason says, but that's what I think. And you have to submerge it. I mean, you just have to submerge it. And reason's always going to object. It's always going to object. But that's just like a child objecting to the parent. But until you get to see that faith is this highest achievement, you're always going to be puzzled by this. I mean, so it is a very, very demanding Christianity.
I think that's right. And what I really like is this thought that until you get to see that faith is higher than reason, you'll never be willing to suspend your reason in this way. And of course he can't give you a reason that will underwrite this claim that faith is higher than your reason. That would be exactly to make the mistake. So what I think of Kierkegaard is doing is showing the internal logic of a non-rationalist, fideist, faith-based position, but all he can do, he can't argue you by reason into that position. He's trying to provoke you into that position by showing you something about how glorious faith would be.
Alexi from Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Alexi.
Hi, thank you. Yes, I think that people make leaps of faith all the time, but to use the example of Abraham is rather extreme. I think people make leaps of faith in order to find out how it's going to work out. And I think this is a common thing. And in some sense, it's quite irrational that you don't know all the factors. You jump in, and you see how things work out. This is not uncommon. such a huge an extreme example as Abraham certainly is a consonant with Kierkegaard's personality, but I think it's a very very unrealistic sort of thing, and I think it's not necessary to posit such a thing, and also not to necessarily think that there's such a great gap between reason and
okay.
faith.
Thanks for the call, Alexi. What do you think, Lydia?
I guess I agreed with everything Alexi said right up until the last thing about the gap between reason and faith. I think it's right that Abraham is a very extreme case, and that Kierkegaard self-consciously presents it as a very extreme case. And I think Kierkegaard does want us to recognize the important role of similar kinds of attitudes in our life. So think again of falling in love. When you fall in love with somebody, you can't talk yourself into love by enumerating all the reasons that the person that you think you're in love with is a good person. When you fall in love with somebody, you're making a kind of bet, just like Alexi suggested, that if I keep engaging with this person, my life will be better in the future, and that bet outstrips whatever reasons you
and
have.
And I think, and to Alexi again, I think you have to realize how consequential for Abraham, for Kierkegaard, this leap of faith is. It is the only thing that will ground a self. I mean, without the leap of faith, you're selfless. You're running from yourself. You might try, if you have a certain kind of despair, you might think you were like king of yourself. You can constitute yourself, figure out what you want, what you value, what you are. But it's always, he says, subject to change and rebellion. And the only stable thing is this direct relation to God through Christ. And Christ is the only real model of selfhood that we have available. And he's very serious about that.
That's true. He's very serious about it. But look, you know, Alexi's right that it's not always as extreme a case. We're not always in as extreme a situation as Abraham was. And because it's so crucial to us, Kierkegaard wants us to know that even in more ordinary circumstances, we still are required to have this kind of attitude.
So we've got an email that poses kind of a meta question here. The title of the email is How Philosophy Talk is Like Sunday School, which might give you a sense of where TenQ, who the email is from. He says, while the discussion of old, moldering, ignorant philosophers of yesteryear is fascinating, it ultimately yields nothing about the nature of the human condition any more than endless discussion of Aristotle and Ptolemy leads to any insight about dynamics and cosmology. All these people are ignorant of modern science. I mean, what's the point? So you guys teach courses on Kierkegaard, apparently. You invite undergraduates to take their units and spill them down the Kierkegaard chute instead of taking geology or science. What's your excuse for this? What ahead, can we really learn from Kierkegaard?
You're the expert in 19th century thinking.
So look, I think we can learn something really important about what the nature of a non-rational attitude of faith would be. And I think that's not that kind of attitude or commitment to that kind of attitude is a very common thing in our culture. And it's really important. Well, so part of the reason I find Kierkegaard so fascinating and interesting to study is that I feel like it gives me insight into what's going on in the psychology of friends and family members of mine who do have this kind of stark religious commitment.
Well, right at present, as I understand, relativity theory and grand cosmological theory and quantum theory can't really be put together. So maybe there's a paradox involved in modern science.
And I want to stick up for Kierkegaard a little more deeply than either of you have, though, because I think that Kierkegaard describes something profound about the human situation. What is the basis of our being in the world? Who are we? What are we? You could say, well, the world, our culture, our history, our nation offers up narratives of what we are to be. Oh, maybe they can be wrong and we can be alienated from our nation. Well, then what then offers up a narrative of who you are and what you are? Well, your own reason. But then you say, why this self rather than that self? And that's a profound question. Why am I this rather than that? And Kierkegaard offers up another kind of answer, a powerful answer, and he argues, I think, persuasively for it, that grounding in the divine that gives you the only stable model of selfhood that is available, all the other ones are going to lead you, even if you're not conscious of it, to despair. Now, I like to get that emailer into our classroom and see how easily he can talk Kierkegaard out of that. I think so, he's just being too quick and shallow.
So you think if I believe that what we are in the world is a bizarre evolutionary accident that'll probably destroy the world, that might lead me to despair?
It might, well, indeed. Lenny, I'll give you one last comment, really briefly.
So look, I agree with you, Ken, that he's on to a very deep problem about how we constitute ourselves. But really, maybe we're just stuck with the situation where
maybe
we have to give ourselves our own self-constitution,
maybe,
and there is no outside force, outside being, that commands us to be that way.
I certainly agree about that. And on that note of agreement, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Our guest has been Lanier Anderson, professor of philosophy from Stanford University. So, John, you got any final thoughts about Kierkegaard?
Yeah, Hegel and Kierkegaard are driving across Denmark, and Hegel says, "Hey, Soren, we've got a flat tire." What does Kierkegaard reply?
I don't know.
"No problem, I've got despair."
Now that's pretty lame, but you know, this conversation continues, I hope not so lamely, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, and also on our Facebook page. We've got almost 3,000 members on our Facebook page, and we'd love for you to get us over that tipping thing.
And you know, you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. Now for the final word, we're going to take a leap of faith. That is that our fast-paced mind of Ian Scholes is going to have something more deep to say than anything you've heard so far in this program. Here he is, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes. Soren Kierkegaard died at 42 in 1855. It wasn't until the 20th century that his writing began to resonate. You can still see traces of Kierkegaard everywhere, or at least the ghost of his traces, in the tragic absurdities of Franz Kafka, the deadpan humor of Donald Barthelme, and the half-blind strivers towards faith of Flannery O'Connor, in existentialism, Ingmar Bergman movies, even in the make-your-own-truth-man ethos of the hippies, there is the ghost of Kierkegaard. Though he himself is not even remotely hippie-like, his beliefs are often put this way: "I cannot believe, and yet I must believe." Much of what Kierkegaard wrote was written under pseudonyms, around 20 in all, which reads like a list of W.C. Fields screenwriters, who, of course, were all W.C. Fields. Kierkegaard presented himself on various pages as Johannes de Silentio, Constantine Constantius, and Hilarious Bookbinder, among others. Why did he do this? Well, Kierkegaard was cursed with both a fertile imagination and a dour Scandinavian Lutheran outlook. It's been surmised that he could only exercise his imagination by pretending to be somebody else, hence the pseudonyms. He was a weird guy, both playful and tortured. One of the few actual events in his cloistered life was when he proposed marriage. The woman accepted, and he was immediately anguished. When he saw her on the street, he avoided her gaze. He came to her house to read to her, listened to her play piano, and sat weeping in a chair instead. Finally, he broke it off. In his journal, he wrote, "Suppose I got married to her. What then? In the course of half a year, in less time than that, she would have torn herself apart. There's something ghostly about me. Fundamentally, I live in a spirit world." He also wrote things like, "My sorrow is my castle. To love God is to hate what is human." Not exactly Hallmark card material. He was well known in Copenhagen for his writing, but also for his personal appearance. Spindly legs, one shorter than the other, stooped posture, a crab-like gait. He was considered a figure of fun, a character, a crank. Children would make fun of him on the street. Even as a child, he was described as an old man, nicknamed the choir boy and the strange one. He described himself as a genius in a market town, which is at once true, self-pitying, and funny. Declining an invitation to a party, he once said, "Let no one invite me, for I do not dance." He was a fascinating figure, not fun to be with exactly, but you're still glad you know him. This strange duck was perhaps the most self-conscious human being who ever lived. Like a character in a Woody Allen movie, only magnified 1,000 times.
"I'm what you would call a teleological existential atheist. I believe that there's an intelligence to the universe, with the exception of certain parts of New Jersey."
I gotta go.
Ian Scholes, the only man who can solve a philosophical problem in 60 seconds.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2010.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch. Lael Weiss is our webmaster.
Also thanks to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
If only God would give me some sign. If he would just speak to me once. Anything, one sentence, two words. If you would just cough.